So you could see the fantastic panel, the incredible view. It means a lot to us. And something we were just discussing ahead of time was the real special part of the CJF and its role in society is that it's the connecting point between industry and journalism. And journalism needs all the friends it can get because it really struggles when it comes to telling its own story. But this evening, we are telling our own story, and it's slightly uncomfortable because so often journalists who may be known to you around the television or bylines, in newsprint or in the digital environment, may consider the journalism to be easy. And it's anything but that. And tonight, with the group we have, you're going to hear a selection of the challenges and our attempt as an industry to explain our business better and to offer up, in some shape, a sense of media literacy so that you really understand what went in to getting the story out. So it is my pleasure to introduce the moderator, Michelle Shepherd, because Shep is a hero, I think, to us all. Michelle. So that can be easy to say, but it's also easy to prove. Shep's jet-lagged because she's just come back from Mogadishu. And I remember the first time Shep went to Mogadishu, and I didn't sleep a wink. I was her editor in 2005, and we had gone through some fairly significant preparations for something you can't prepare for, which is to say that, yeah, Michelle, you can go, and Pete Power, the photographer, you can both go, but we're going to have protocol. You're going to have to phone me or contact me in some way every couple of hours so I know you're safe and I know you're alive. And in doing so, we couldn't know what we would do if we didn't hear from her. And Michelle was able to contact me, not exactly on time, but within the hour after the hour in which she was supposed to. And we were able to deliver some pretty special work. And I think what it did was it woke up in Michelle a sense that there was a whole world out there. Working at the Toronto Star, a very strong newspaper that has a diaspora of the world that lives in the city, and how she could relate that readership back to itself by going to very troubled areas. And over the years, it's been my delight to watch Michelle progress, develop, become not only a documentary maker, but also the winner of the highest standard award in Canadian journalism, of the Michener Award for Public Service Journalism. Her countless visits to Guantanamo Bay, a prison that we should remind people remains open, and her determination to tell a story that is not only difficult to tell, but a brave one to tell. So I can't think of anyone more qualified to take on this evening's discussion on the dangers of the field than Michelle Shepherd.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, David. And we won't continue this mutual love club, but David was my first foreign editor, and really the year when you were my editor, was the first foreign correspondent, foreign work that I did. And I remember that same year that we went to Mogadishu, David had said, where do you really need to go to cover the national security beat that no one else is doing right now in Canada? And I said, Pakistan. And he said, okay, go to Pakistan for 2 weeks, take a photographer, and if you don't come back with any stories, that's fine. And it was the best psychology ever, because who says that? No editor says that. Certainly no editor today would say that. And because of that, I don't think I've ever produced more stories, because I was going to prove them. So I thank him for the opportunity that continues today. And I won't do his gushing, lovely
go ahead.
Introduction. Especially for Paul Hunter, obviously. But please let me introduce this panel. I'm really delighted to be here. We have so much experience right here, and thank you all for coming for this. Dr. Anthony, and also I get to say, if I make any mistakes today, it's because of Mogadishu, so I hope you're all sort of jet-lagged in some similar fashion, so you're allowed to use that excuse. Dr. Anthony Feinstein is a friend I've known many years, and he's professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto and Sunnybrook Health Science Centre. He's devoted much of his career to studying mental trauma among mental health trauma among journalists, and he's the author of 4 books on this subject, one of which was turned into a documentary, which he produced and won a 2012 Peabody, and it was shortlisted for an Oscar. So he's going to provide some perspective and real knowledge to much of what we're talking about. Peter Ackman is an investigative correspondent with CTV's W5. During his extensive career, he's reported from Libya during the fall of Gaddafi, from Egypt during the Tahrir Square Revolution. He spent 2 months in Afghanistan while embedded with the Canadian Armed Forces right after 9/11. Peter's also been on the ground for 5 Olympics, the Thai cave rescue, and covered the aftermath of the recent shootings in Paris, Manchester, Orlando, and Vegas. And I'm anticipating that's going to be a big part of what we talk about, too, those shootings. Ioana Ramiliotis, thank you for joining us a little bit last minute here. We appreciate you being here. She's an award-winning senior reporter with CBC's National News. And she began her career in 1995 in Montreal, and in 2000 began with the National, where she is today. She covered the 9/11 attacks, and more recently she has investigated Canada's Me Too movement, starting with Gian Gomeshi, as he quipped, which was the original Me Too. And for months, she followed the Bruce MacArthur serial murder investigation. Ioana also covered Toronto's van attack, which was a devastating day for everyone, and I think, again, will come up today because of some of the local tragedies that we cover and often don't talk about as much as the foreign work. Paul Hunter is an absolute asshole, and he's...
That's it, I'm out.
That's it. Just put away the paper. That's it.
He's well known, and CBC, not a well-known asshole, he's just well-known for his amazing journalism. He's a CBC correspondent based in Washington. He's a CBC correspondent based in Washington, which is perhaps one of the greatest war zones today. He's an award-winning journalist, and over more than 30 years has not only covered the Trump and Obama administrations, but also the Rio Olympics, the Boston bombing, the Newton massacre, the earthquake in Haiti, the tsunami in Japan, and in 2014, the war in Gaza Strip. And he's also covered both Canada's involvement in the war of Afghanistan and the BP oil spill, and I just want to please help me in welcoming all of our panelists. So I have a bunch of great storytellers to my left. So I'm hoping we can make this really just a conversation. Picture us all at a pub, and we're sharing war stories and the impact of those. And then at the end, we'll have time for questions and answer, and I'll leave lots of time for that. So I just want to start, and I'll throw this out to all panelists, starting with Peter, just a broad question and sort of an overview of how we find the job has changed today as opposed to in the past, in what we cover, and what are your biggest challenges? And that's a huge question, but I think all of us have had fairly lengthy careers, and it is quite different today. How is it most significantly different?
Well, it doesn't stop. That's the biggest thing. Buzzing in my pocket right now is some tweet of some sort of somebody either doing something and not happy with something, commenting on what I've said, what I was wearing, or anything that I've reported on. And so the news doesn't stop. There is no, you know, you hit your 10 o'clock mark or 11 o'clock mark, depending on what show you're on. And
9 o'clock.
Really? It's
we
on
have an earlier deadline.
Oh, I didn't realize it was on then. Sorry. So CBC's on at 9 o'clock, but don't worry, Grey's Anatomy's on then on CTV. So the deadline of 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock doesn't matter anymore because at 1 o'clock, we're still doing shows. At 2 o'clock, we're their producers coming in for the morning shows, the 24-hour channels. There's Twitter is on all the time, as Donald Trump has proven. And so the news just doesn't stop for us. And so, and neither does the gathering, and neither does thinking about what's coming, because it's already there. And so for me, it's, you know, you get to that 10 o'clock mark 10 years ago, and you got to have a glass of wine and take a breath, recharge, change your socks, and go again. Then now it just doesn't end.
Joanna?
I think adding to that, or building to that, is the fact that we are now servicing more platforms. When I started at the Canadian Press way back in Montreal, I was just a print reporter. And then I went to the Gazette, and then went to CBC, and I was just a TV reporter. Now we file for radio, we file for online, we have to figure out social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, IGTV. So there's always these different ways of storytelling, and we've all had to adapt to telling our story for all these different platforms, and it is quite different. The one thing, though, that I do find consistent in all the years since I started is the value of a good story. Everybody still wants a good story. The way you introduced it very aptly, let's talk as if we're at a pub, that's the same way viewers, readers, listeners still want to hear the news of the day. They want you to contextualize it. They want to they want to hear a story, as opposed to a series of facts that have been flying on Twitter all day or anywhere else, or on radio. They just want to hear it all kind of put together. So the biggest change, I think, has been the platforms. The one thing that has remained consistent, I think, is that.
Because now you're doing radio, TV, online, and all the social media.
Yeah, platforms. But it all has to be a story. At the end of the day, the value of a story has never, I hope, and I'm glad for that, has never waned.
Yeah, I would echo all of that and add a couple of things. I think, well, I mean, and certainly the relentlessness of the news cycle is kind of insane. And Trump is a particular moment in time. I literally begin every day by reaching for the iPhone and seeing what he's tweeted overnight, because it will dictate not my day, but the first part of my day, because it'll change. And it, as you face deadline after deadline, the story change, blah, blah, all that is the sort of foundation. Beyond those things, I would say a couple. One, lately, relative to when I started in this, is the imperative to get closer to the shit, to get out there and get to be where it's happening, no matter how awful it is, or no matter how scary it is, or how anguishing it is, to get in the face of the story, because it's so uber competitive. And if you aren't there, somebody else will be. And as the industry is having a complicated time right now, I just find that imperative is stronger than it has ever been. Just go, and if you're not right in the face of it, you've failed somehow. The other thing that is I've found particular in the States is this business of fake news. And it has changed the landscape in how I do my job. It used to be, especially in America, when I first went down there in the I guess 08 or so. Man, oh man, Americans walk up to you when they find you're a journalist and they say, thank you. You know, you play an integral role in the democratic process. Well, that's changed. Truth is a moving target now. And reporters aren't respected the way they were before. And I don't mean that in a self-serving way. It's just, it complicates things. People want to know who you are, what your network is, in my case, what the agenda is. You know, I won't go on, but at a Trump rally in Houston, just before the midterms, which are particular animals, the mood changes when he walks in, right? A happy crowd becomes a raucous, fake news, jeering, booing, which affects you, you know what I mean? Because you're just here doing your job. But beforehand, I was just doing little interviews with people and yada, yada, yada about the story that I was working on. And then there was a lull while we were waiting. So I went up to some of these very nice ladies who I just wanted to chat with about it and say, like, what's up, right? Like, how can you, what do you like about this guy? And now that we know this is not that, you know, after 2 years of Trump. And they, we just like what he says and what he does. And I said, well, how do you get your information? And they, all of them, in unison said InfoWars. Do you know about InfoWars? You know, and it's like, that's the truth, they said. And they were very nice and sweet about it. But this is where they get their information. I'm thinking, that complicates our lives. And it's what we confront every day now in a way that we never did before Trump anyway.
Well, I think all three of you have raised three important points that I just want to explore a little further, and then we'll jump to you, Anthony, to sort of help us with the definitions. But three ways in which it adds stress and could impact the mental health of journalists in ways that we don't traditionally think about, which is the, you know, in the field correspondent and what you witness. And one is just the stress of always being on. You know, this constant deadline, you're constantly feeding the beast. So you really have, it's difficult to have that mental relaxation. The two you mentioned sort of in a funny way, Peter, but was that instant feedback about what you're wearing and that sort of stuff. But I think there is also instant feedback that can be very damaging too and difficult to do your job. And then third, of course, is the fake news. So you've sort of said, Paul, how that impacts you. Does it make you feel a bit frustrated? Like, what am I doing now?
It does, and it sounds it doesn't sound like that big a deal when you put it into words, in a way, except it's the relentlessness of it. It's a dark time. And you get into this business, I find anyway, or I did, in a kind of young and bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, altruistic kind of, I'm going to change the world.
Now
and
you're really old.
Tell stories. That's right. It was a long time ago. So it kind of, it beats you down every day, and you come to relish the positive feedback that we, in fairness, that you still get. But I just find it's certainly the story that I'm on now most of the time. It's not aspirational, and it's not hopeful. It's every day is dark. Every day is a bummer, and it kind of gets to you after a while. I mean, this is like, it's not a war zone, but I have found the relentlessness of the negativity, it beats you down.
I actually find it bleeds out of your job and into punchlines of jokes and in talking with your family. I was at a family event and somebody made a joke, oh, that's fake news. And honestly, that term now is like, it's like using profanity towards, or a term to describe, you know, a racist term. To me, it sits in my gut, and I tell this to people that I'm close enough to say this to, and I say, please don't use that term. It's like saying a bad word to a minority, or to, you know, you just shouldn't do it. It's not everything I do every day. When I get on a plane and I leave my kids and my wife and I fly somewhere terrible, I do that because I'm bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Still,
he's not.
But I do that because I have this idea that what I'm going to do will help somebody. But as soon as that word is used, I don't even know how to explain what it does in my head. It's like a red flag in front of a bull. It makes me so frustrated that you can sum up everything I do in a day over 6 hours or 12 hours or 18 hours or never ending days with that.
You know, if I could jump in, we've been to Puerto Rico twice since Hurricane Maria. And that was a place that was, by Trump's definition, not really suffering. The death toll really wasn't as high as it was. So as much as I empathize with Peter's feeling about what we do being fake or fabricated or made up or slanted or biased or whatever the word might be, when you see people who are devastated emotionally, physically, they have no homes, and they're part of the U.S., and they're being told, or the messaging from the mainland is that they're not really suffering. That's the kind of stuff that's infuriating to witness, to report on, and then just to feel that kind of, you know, it's not being seen in the most ignorant way, right? When it's in your face and you're just turning away from it. I find that part very astounding and appalling.
I was amazed as trying to make light of it. I have the same feeling that it angers me. For Halloween, I went as fake news, covered myself in newsprint and put fake and had a little press hat. Every kid who came to the door in my neighborhood, fake news, they knew immediately. Yeah. Immediately. I mean, it was a great costume, obviously, but I couldn't believe how much of a common term. So can you put this into perspective, what everything you're hearing there that is not traditionally what we think of as PTSD? And there's another term I want you to explain that might come out naturally in that.
So I'm not a journalist, but the work that I've done with journalists initially focused on post-traumatic stress disorder, because we did a series of studies looking at journalists who had come back from war zones or from disasters, and these were events that were associated with, you know, enormous numbers of people dying, and they were very stressful, and journalists had died, and, you know, we found that, not surprisingly, journalists were not immune to post-traumatic stress disorder. So if you can confront an event that led to the death of other people or could have killed you, then potentially you are at risk for something like PTSD. And I think for me, the big eye-opener was when I started this work 2 decades back, was that your profession wasn't aware of what PTSD was, really. And so there were journalists who were developing this significant problem and they weren't getting help or assistance. And I think, you know, journalism has moved a long way over the last couple of decades. And now, you know, when people come back from a war zone or from a particularly traumatic situation, they can get the kind of help that you would give to someone who's got post-traumatic stress disorder. I think what's different now is that we're aware of more subtle aspects of trauma that don't necessarily meet the bar for a formal mental illness. And the thing that I'm, you know, very interested in is something called moral injury, which, listening to all three of these discussions over, you know, these stories over here, I see evidence of moral injury. And so what is that? It's not a mental illness, but it's a sense that you might have done something to transgress your own moral compass, or you have witnessed other people do things that transgress what you consider a moral compass. It might be your colleagues, it might be your leaders or your politicians, it can be your fellow citizens, it can be your news organization. And you have a sense of you yourself or other people losing their moral way, that somehow you've got yourself into these choppy waters in which morality has gone out the window, and you are implicated in this through something that you might have done or something, in fact, that you failed to do. We speak about acts of commission, things that you did, which in retrospect you regret because you think it was morally wrong, or you regret not having done something. So acts of omission, which can also leave you with a sense of moral injury. And the emotions associated with moral injury, the predominant emotions are shame and guilt, but there can be other emotions as well. And journalists and news organizations don't recognize the power of moral injury to hurt people. The military have known about this for a long time. So, you know, when soldiers came back from the war in Iraq and they'd been told one thing before they left, but by, you know, when they came back, they realized that, hold on a second, we had been sold a false bill of goods over here, that we hadn't really built democracy, we hadn't built a country, that we had been unwitting dupes in the destruction of a country. You know, soldiers came back with a sense of moral injury, and that distressed them. And that could become a conduit down the road to things like depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. So the military, who are often ahead of us on many, many issues, understood and still understand that moral injury can be a significant problem. And I think within journalism, it's potentially a problem too, because you are confronting very difficult questions in which you have to make difficult decisions, and you, maybe you don't get the decision right, or maybe you make a mistake, or maybe your news boss sitting, you know, all the way away from things in Toronto has made the wrong decision. And you tend to have a sense, well, no, this isn't right. This is morally wrong. And those things can be very distressing to people. And I don't think there's been a discussion about this yet.
Knowing that definition, can any of the three of you think of instances that you think would define what could be moral injury?
I think every bad story we see, right? Every bad story we cover is usually based on somebody harming other people, especially disasters or the van attack. Bruce MacArthur. Like, but there's plenty of domestic stories.
But you said even by you were happy to be there, Puerto Rico. So even though it's depressing, you were doing something to make it better.
You're bearing witness to people's stories, right? And you're bringing people's stories to the public eye. And I think that is a service for frankly, and I think we all try to be thoughtful and mindful that we're not there to advocate, we're there to offer a platform. You can help, but be affected by situations that are so blatantly wrong, or see people suffering so badly and having no help and dealing with politicians who are giving them bland kind of placating assurances. So in that respect, you do get involved, but I think at the end of the day, we all see things and just simply try to, as accurately as possible, reflect them.
The speed of the news cycle causes, I feel, causes some maybe rips in the striations of something that's going on. I went to Bangladesh, the Rohingya crisis that was happening there. I spent 3 weeks going in and out of this refugee camp with a million people and counting every single day, seeing people who were burned and women who were raped and men who had limbs hacked off and living in dirt and under plastic tents. And I went there and I reported every day, and I blogged and I did online pieces and I posted, did live hits and radio and pumped as much as I could out into the world to expose this genocide that's happening there. And then I got a call from my producer who said that we needed to have a conference call and I had to come back. And I thought, it's a little soon, but I get it. Budgets are budgets. And I made sure in that call that I said, like, you know, there are things that are getting worse. There are issues that need to be addressed. We need to come back. So I left and felt terrible about it. But as we tend to do when we leave people who are still in a similar position to what we how we found them. But since then, I've been pressing the executive producers to go back. And we haven't gone back. And this story has disappeared. And so the cycle has rolled over it, and the next thing came up, and there was, you know, a fire or a terror attack or an earthquake, and you go to that, and you remember, oh yeah, remember where I was a month ago, then 6 months ago, then a year ago, and you keep saying, we need to go back. And then you get emails from people saying, this is what's now going on. Are you coming back now? Is this bad enough for you? And you're starting to feel some guilt that, why aren't we back there? Why aren't we shining the light back on this thing that's happening? And so the cycle just rolls over it, and it's got to flare up big time for it to come back onto the cycle.
To me, and I'll say a couple things, and some of this echoes that. To me, the biggest way to combat moral injury is, cliche as it may sound, is giving a voice to those who don't have a voice. An example would be a couple of pieces we did in the last couple of years out of Baltimore, which is a pretty messed up place. And so we did a piece after the Freddie Gray riots, if you recall that, the fellow that was killed in police custody. And then we went back last year. In the Freddie Gray time, people didn't want to talk to us because they, back to fake news, they didn't believe that we wanted to tell their actual story, which is about how messed up Baltimore is and how messed up, especially messed up it is for black people in Baltimore. They did not, and I convinced people, and when they said what they wanted to say, that you, like, you could see their shoulders sagging, like, he's listening, he's gonna put this on TV. So that felt good, right? This past year, we went, when those kids, after Parkland, and there was the big march on DC, bona fide, absolutely, go for it. That was the I call bullshit thing, right? So that was happening. And I woke up one morning, and after reading Trump's tweets, I flipped on the radio. And like on the local news, the fifth story in was about a kid in Baltimore who was shot outside his school. And I thought, that never makes headlines. And we went up and we went to this high school and we met three kids in that school. The teacher told us eight kids in that school had been shot within a year. Everybody in that 8-minute piece that we met either had been shot or knew people who had been shot. They're all black, and they all felt nobody ever tells that story. And we put it on the CBC, and I tell you, I don't think I felt better about any story I did because everybody we talked to was given a voice that otherwise wouldn't. And to me, that combat, that is the best pushback against moral injury, which is the second part of what I was going to say. I won't go on forever. But to me, it's when you're that asshole who has to go and talk to somebody whose daughter had just been shot, or son, or nephew, or brother, or mother, or father, and you're that jerk. And you're doing your job. And it rips me apart, and I've done it often. And it rips me apart every single time. You do it because it's your job. You do it with respect. And a lesson I learned very early on, which has stayed with me, and I consider it a protection against moral injury, which is to say, before they slam the door on your face, here's why you shouldn't talk to me. And here's why you might want to, and you decide. It's only a news story, right? And I'll lay out some things. And I find if you bring respect to the table, you get respect, and you can tell a story that the people whose lives have been ripped apart more than mine, I feel bad knocking on your door. These are the lives that matter. And if you bring respect to it, man, there's no better protection against moral injury.
You know, just if I can jump in quickly, based on that, when in Lakmeg on Sick, and Peter was there as well when that train blew through that town and killed so many people, we knocked on all the doors, as you have, it was as we've all done. And I'll never forget, we ended up doing a whole talk back on this because there was no pictures, nobody wanted to talk. But they all said, thank you for asking us. And it was, there's a certain grace to their grief that was striking, but it was also stunning to me that even in this awful, awful aftermath, that they felt that being asked that question simply to, you know, have a moment to share was valuable, and they respected us for asking. Of course, you don't barge in. We're not the prototypical reporters who are just clamoring. It's very respectful, and obviously that goes a long way, but I think at the end of the day, the fact of being asked is something that many people value, and we assume that nobody wants to talk. They do, even if it is to say, I can't talk right now. And I think there's a lot of value in protecting, as Paul said, against that moral injury simply by being that messenger.
Where's Catherine Clark, who produced a story with me in Texas after a shooting last year? We had to go up to all those people. Remember that? I watched that story 2 days ago because I'm giving a talk to journalism students at Humber tomorrow, and I cried because people opened up to us about what this meant. And there was a sense of, we want people to know, even in Texas and gunsling in Texas, that this ain't on. I've cried 3 times in the field in this career. In Haiti after the earthquake, in Newtown after the shooting, and in the Bernardo trial. And it's complicated, but in each of those stories, it's everything that I've just said. If you do your job, you feel better about it. If you do your job with respect, you feel doubly better, and you can get through the day. And so that's what we all try to do.
This is a good point, time to note something that we talked about ahead that we just want to put out there, that while we're delving into this, all of us feel kind of silly and selfish talking about this topic when we appreciate that it's the people we interview that are the traumatized one. It feels kind of indulgent talking about how we've been traumatized. And also, our colleagues who are local reporting. I think all of us have had that feeling that when we've been abroad and you have a fixer, somebody helping you, they tend to be local journalists. And this could be partly a moral injury, but the point being of raising this, that we almost don't feel we can call them colleagues because these are such brave local journalists that we get to get on a plane and come home, and they stay there. But
Anthony, what's from what Paul just said? I mean, Paul and Joanna, you find a way to do it and live with yourself. And I think, you know, you knocking on the door and saying I wouldn't talk to me, or you don't have to, here's the reasons why you might not want to. That's probably come after a lot of experience. I know I was similar, I would have had a similar coping way in how I would talk to people. But when you're a new reporter, an intern, you're so desperate, especially right now, it's so competitive, to get that victim, to get the story, and you're inexperienced, and you may not be able to come back without that person. Whereas if Paul comes back, his editors know he's tried everything and this person isn't gonna talk. Is there any advice you can give to some of the managers who are in the room, or just generally, or maybe among ourselves, helping younger colleagues? How do you deal with this in a way that you can help them so they're not feeling that type of?
Well, I mean, just hearing what you said, I mean, you know, you got it right. And I think, you know, when you do a very powerful story like the Baltimore story and your news organization runs with it, you know, that's a sense of validation and you getting the story out. And so that becomes the antidote to moral injury. But imagine if your news organization had not run with it. And then how does that leave you feeling? And so I've come across so many instances in which, you know, journalists have very compelling stories and they don't get them out there, that they get, you know, the news that's put out there might be far more trivial and that leads to a real sense of outrage on the part of the journalist. The other thing about learning, of course, is you learn from mistakes as well. And so often learning from mistakes is the most powerful lesson. And so I think there's going to be no antidote to making mistakes, and people have to make mistakes to learn. But a discussion like this, I think, is very important because it starts educating your profession about what moral injury is. And, you know, young journalists can learn from older journalists. You can learn from the careers of people who've done it before, who've made the mistakes, who've paid the price, and who have come out a lot wiser because of it. And so I think mentorship can become a really important thing for students. And the very fact that you're going to Humber tomorrow to speak to journalists is a wonderful thing, because you will convey, you know, the wisdom of your career and what you've learned to students. So that's a very powerful way to do it. But at the end of the day, you know, you can't make the world nice. You know, you can't wrap up everything and make it neat and tidy, that there's going to be lots of nastiness, lots of mistakes, lots of errors, an enormous amount of pain there that you can't contain. And how you deal with that becomes a challenge for you. And I think it's an enduring challenge. I don't think it ever goes away. I think it stays with you for the duration of your career. You may get a bit better at dealing with it, but these are things that you will confront given the choices that you've made with respect to your career. So I think education becomes pivotal to getting people familiar with what we're speaking about. A meeting like this tonight is so important because we're touching on moral injury. You're learning from people who might have experienced it and how they've dealt with it. But at the end of the day, the world is a complicated and a difficult place. And when you confront a lot of pain, there are no easy solutions. And I think it is inevitable that you will feel that distress yourself.
And why is it that some journalists seem to not have issues with PTSD? Maybe not even with moral injury, although I think we've all touched on small examples of moral injury. And Peter, you and I have talked about this before, that there almost is a guilt that comes with you coming back.
Really?
And people saying like, oh, you must be so fucked up. Like, and you're like, I'm actually okay. And that, and you do feel bad because you're like, how am I? Am I a psychopath? How am I witnessing this and coming back? And don't answer the psychopath question. That's a whole other discussion. But why? How is it that we're functioning, we're doing our jobs, and I have friends that have PTSD, and it's really debilitating, and they really crumble.
So the other side of the coin is that the majority of journalists don't develop post-traumatic stress disorder. They won't develop moral injury. We just speak about it now because it's an interesting topic and that's what I study. But there is this, you know, this thing called resilience, and what defines it is really a bit of a conundrum. I mean, you don't know in advance which soldiers going off to combat will develop PTSD and who won't. I mean, there's a marvelous book on the history of military psychiatry by Ben Shepherd, the English historian, in which he makes a point that, you know, the first man court-martialed for cowardice during the Great War was a gridiron hero. So, I mean, these things become really difficult to predict. But as we become more familiar with biology, as we understand brain science, we start getting clues as to why some person might develop a problem and someone else might not. So we did a study a few years back in which we brought two identical twins to Toronto, one of whom was a war journalist and the other one was not. And they were identical twins. We confirmed this with genetic testing. And the two sisters were very close. They one lived in Vancouver, one lived in the United Kingdom. They brought the photograph album with them. We could see that when they were small, they looked absolutely identical. They grew up in a small English village. Their mother dressed them in the exact same clothes. They were called 21 and 22. You couldn't tell them apart. And then suddenly they get to adolescence, and you start seeing their personalities differentiating. And the one twin, at the age of 16, decides this very quiet, bucolic English village is not for me. It's just, you know, it's too boring. And she packs up and goes off to South America, learns Portuguese, and starts navigating her way around a continent by herself. Her co-twin is distraught. I mean, her closest friend, her sister, the person whom she shared a bed with when they were growing up, has now left. She tries to do a similar thing by going across to France, hops across the channel, you know, much closer to home. After 1 week, she just can't stomach anymore, comes back to this quiet English village. And so you start seeing their careers diverge in the most dramatic ways. And by the time they came to Toronto, the one twin was a very celebrated war journalist. She'd been given the OBE. She had spent her lifetime in war zones in the world's worst places. And her co-twin had had a very quiet life. She married young. She had a couple kids. She lived the suburban life. She worked, you know, from 9 o'clock till four. She was part of the country club, whereas her co-twin was, you know, gallivanting around the world. The one who stayed behind for the domestic life didn't smoke, didn't drink, was good at managing money. Her co-twin was bad at managing money, smoked like a trooper, and drank more than the Canadian Medical Association said you should drink. And so the question is this: how do you get such fundamentally different behaviors in people who are, you know, identical? So we tried to work this out. And the first surprise that we had was when we put the, you know, the domestic twin into an MRI machine. I don't know if any of you have had an MRI, but it's slightly claustrophobic, and there's this, you know, knocking noise in your ear. She has a panic attack, you know. Whereas her sister, the war journalist, said, you know, what's an MRI? An MRI is nothing. You know, I mean, I've gone to war zones in Africa, exactly. You know, and so we try to get a clue as to what differentiated them. And I think at the end of the day, it boils down to something called epigenetics. So although you have the same genetic makeup, your genes will express themselves differently because of little switches that are to be found on the genes that can turn on a gene and turn off a gene. Now, I'm not a geneticist and I'm not an expert on epigenetics, but we teamed up with the experts at CAMH who could map all the genetic markers for these two women. And we found some epigenetic differences. And one of those differences controlled a neural pathway that modulated anxiety. And so the co-twin who stayed behind with a suburban lifestyle basically was an anxious person because she never had this particular epigenetic marker that could modulate the neurotransmitters and the pathway that we know is important for anxiety. Her co-twin, who had the OBE, who was a celebrated war journalist, didn't experience anxiety. Even when she was in, you know, the genocide in the Congo, she never experienced anxiety because she could modulate her responses through her innate biology. And so we start getting clues as to what differentiates one person from another. Now, this is a very reductionistic explanation of something, but I do think there's no escaping biology for some of this.
I love, you've told me about that study before. I love it. I cite it all the time. I blame my epigenetics for everything.
Well, you're fortunate.
You were, when I said that sometimes there's that guilt when you're not traumatized.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've experienced that?
When I was first, we all do something called AKE training. It's hostile regions training. When I was first asked to go somewhere terrible, you go there and they run you through scenarios. My bone is sticking out of my leg. I have a compound fracture. I'm being held at gunpoint. All of the different scenarios that you go through. And part as I moved through that training, we'd finish something and I'd turn to somebody and make a joke, and then we'd do something else terrible and dramatic, and I'd do the same thing. And if you can't tell already, present company excluded, in terms of making sort of off-color jokes at weird times, without being a geneticist, because I only play one on TV once in a while, that seems to be what I see allows it to run off your back. I made one bad joke during that AKE training course, And the fellow who was leading it, who was a former British paramilitary trooper, stopped the whole thing. And he said, he pointed to me and he said, "Ackman, if you ever go into a war zone, I'll be happy to come with you."
Really?
And I was so confused. And so was my boss, who was getting pissed off that I kept making these little jokes. And I didn't understand. He said, "Because you'll be able to, you know, tell the story, see what's going on, and then pack up and walk away and make that sort of maybe off-color joke a little bit and then move on to the next thing. It's sort of water off a duck's back." And when I come back from different situations, everyone wants to hear how terrible it was. And I have no problem telling people how terrible it was. It's what we do. We live on TV, live on the radio, in tape pieces. We tell people, we reflect back what's going on. But if you ask me how terrible it was for me, I mean, it's sad and terrible to meet these people whose lives have been, you know, washed away, or their siblings have been killed, or they're living in horror, in hell, in the worst places on earth. But I don't have to live there. Like you say, you leave these journalists who are your fixers behind. Those are the people I want you to worry about their situation. Not me. I go in, I come out. I go in, I come out. And I make a joke at the end of the day, and I think that protects me a little bit, maybe. And that's really, I feel bad about it, and people look at me like, "You are, what did you say, psychopath?"
I think so, yeah.
Honestly, I mean, my mother calls me frantically, or I send a note, and, "Are you okay?" "Yep, I'm good. Good, no problem."
Having said that, I know from our past conversations that all of us have a few that really you revisit at times and you're okay with, you're coping with, but do stay with you. Ioana, we were emailing about this a bit. The van attack was devastating for many people in Toronto. Describe your day and how it's kind of impacted what you do.
You know, it's interesting because we, at that point, we had already been covering Bruce MacArthur for several months. So, and that was an appalling story, and every police update was more grisly than the last. So it was in my head, but it was almost like a CSI. I think I was telling you in an email. It was almost like we were reporting on a very long, protracted CSI episode, investigative pieces. We found a body part here. There's this. There's that. But for mainly because the family members of the victims were very private, at least at that point in the story, you didn't have that emotional kind of connection or storytelling. It was just very clinical, fascinating in a way. And like Peter, you kind of almost morbidly became fascinated with it. And then the van attack happens, and we left. We were literally meeting with a contact on MacArthur, and they called us, head up to Yonge and Finch. And as we were getting there, I'm thinking, oh my God, I was here with my kids a couple of days ago, and I'm never there, right? It's just this random place of Toronto. And then it became very clear that this was an attack, and it wasn't an accident. And what stayed with me, and like Peter and Paul have mentioned, the demands of the news gets you through the worst of it because you're so busy. You have to file, you have to interview, you have to find a camera. Yeah, it's just so intense. And in the minute or two that you have downtime, and that's an eternity in our jobs, that's when it starts to hit you. And on that story, it was the fact that we got there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and at 9 o'clock we were still there because we were going live, and the bodies were still on Yonge Street. Because the coroner hadn't been able to, you know, they have to go to every single spot. They have to proclaim the person is dead, and then that body can be moved away. But that took hours because the stretch of Yonge Street was so long. And I remember in those one or two downtime minutes thinking, that's somebody's sister, that's somebody's father. And it was cold. And that day was a really warm, beautiful April day, but by 9 o'clock it was freezing the way the weather's turning now. And I just kept thinking, these people are cold, even though they're dead. And a police officer came to me after, and he said, and the fact that it's really hard to watch, you know, the police officers are walking around the power, and it's just like, they're just going about their business, and people are lying down, covered in tarp. And an officer, I remember, we interviewed the next day, said a phone kept ringing under one of the tarps. and this was broken. And the cell display was mom. And that phone just rang dozens of times. Because imagine, some mother is desperately looking for their child. And that was, to me, you know, you're covering. We've covered so many tough stories, but there's moments like that when it hits you, when you allow yourself to just simply not be on as a journalist and be there as a human being, where you're just horrified. Yeah. And then you just move on, because you have to. And Gallo's humor helps, and other kind of support, especially from fellow journalists who are all on the scene. We help each other in tremendous ways. But there are moments like that just hit you. They just hit you. Yeah.
Danforth shooting was that for? I live a block away from where it started, or a couple blocks away, and quite literally that afternoon, I was there with my two kids, and we got ice cream, and then we left. And the choice was: do we go out for a late ice cream or an early ice cream? And we made the choice to get the early ice cream so that we could go home and read. And so we did that. And then reading got canceled because my phone rang and I was back exactly to where I was earlier that day. And the same people were working at the time. That's the amazing thing, is because we stopped in at Corso Shoes and we stopped in at this other kitchen store. And the same people who were there 4 hours before, their lives had totally changed. Yeah. And so, but you go there and you stop being the, you know, here's me and the two kids and going store to store, and you start being the reporter, and you have to.
Yeah, and that helps. It helps. It definitely, it's like a shield, yeah. Right? It's totally like a shield. But to your point, when we've all covered traumatic incidences, but when they're home, when they're close to home, it's a whole other level, because this is our escape. You go with your kids. I was at Young and Finch with my kids, and I'm never there, but yeah. I was there 2 days before. It suddenly comes too close, right?
So. And Paul, I want you to speak to this as well, but I'm just going to let Anthony jump in.
Just very quickly, I mean, what you've touched on there is something called moral luck, which is that you can be at a place at a point in time, and you're completely fine, and the person who comes 2 hours after you gets killed. And that's just one of these chance phenomena, but that can determine the course of your life. And moral luck works to your advantage, but it works to your disadvantage. And I hear this time and time again with journalists and people who've been through traumatic events, that it was your great misfortune to be at a particular point at a particular place in time in which the consequences were so devastating that they color your life. And that's moral luck. And there are many examples of that in your profession.
I know I've only had one sort of close call, and I, to this day, have like the AK-47 shells by my bed, just as a sort of almost guilty reminder from what happened.
A couple things. Here's how you go to a war zone. Your phone rings, and your boss says, "Do you want to go?" And then your boss says, "Do you really want to go? We won't hold it against you if you don't want to go." And all you're thinking is, of course you will. I'll never leave the plant again if I say no. I guess it's not technically the first time, but when I went to a war zone. But when I went to Afghanistan for one of the longer 5 or 6 week things, that phone call came. And really, what you're thinking is physical injury. What will I get shot or an IED or whatever? And it's, I find it's only the back of my head that you start, and especially when you're there day after day after day, that you start thinking, is there going to be anything else? I likened it, I was saying to some people earlier, when you say yes, that little small part of the story, you kind of step on what I've called a conveyor belt of fate that just carries you forward, and you're on it now. And I think you have, from a professional perspective, an obligation not to say no the rest of that journey. And so when you're in Kandahar at the airfield and some seats come up on a mission out into the wilds of Afghanistan and you're offered it, you are going to say yes. And then that conveyor belt is now taking you onto an APC and you're getting on with soldiers and you're going out in the Taliban and IEDs and on, in terms of the luck thing on this particular one, our convoy was heading out south of Kandahar City, and we stopped because there'd been an IED the day before and the road had been blown apart. And so the engineers had to get out and make sure that it was all okay. And this delayed us about 20 minutes. And we kind of crept around the thing. And then we continued down the highway. Then we turn off on a dirt road. And we're going down a dirt road toward the forward operating base. And there's another convoy coming out on the same dirt road. We're in the lead vehicle in our convoy. And the convoy coming out hits an IED that we were headed for. Thing blows up in front of us. Had we not stopped on that highway, there's the luck, that was sitting there waiting for us. So that's the physical, right, that you worry about. And every single day in Afghanistan, you are, or in Gaza or wherever, but at the back of your mind. And I thank God that I'm in that 375% that I don't feel any, it's a glib question, would you go back? Or to answer quickly to the question, would you go back, I think is wrong. You have to make a thoughtful, because it is physically risky. But the other, I don't know, and you just don't know. Like you wonder if cumulatively, if you go to enough war zones, will you come back shaking, you know? Just very quickly in Haiti, after the earthquake, that's when you saw, man, oh man, like day one, we met this guy who was building a coffin for his dad who was in the rubble behind that had died. He was talking to him as he kind of died. They couldn't get him out fast enough. That was like day one. We're trying to get down to the, every block you went was another story, and you knew the real shit was down there, and every day is heartbreaking, right? We finally get down toward the sort of epicenter in Port-au-Prince, and there's like, this body is on fire because they were afraid of disease, so you just see this. And then you get out of the vehicle with your little camera and you're looking at, and what is the best angle? Because it's hard, is that a hand, you know? And we went around a corner and there was like, they were trying to pull somebody out of the rubble. And again, you feel like an asshole because you're trying to get closer to the shot. And the crowd parts. Come on in. The world has to see this because we need help. Mm-hmm. And so this comes back to the protection. The next day we went to a mass grave and you're seeing body parts all over the place and you think, what the hell? Mm-hmm. Right? And I don't know. It's that, to me, it's that you don't know what this does over a period of time, whether it's 3 weeks in Haiti after an earthquake, 6 weeks in Afghanistan during a wartime, or 30 years of reporting on the things like that we all see, and it's,
I think there's something else in that often doesn't get talked about. And then after we discuss this, we'll open it up for questions. But there is something that makes it sound almost ghoulish, but I was reminded of this just on this most recent trip, because it's been a while since I've been somewhere. But there's also an addiction to it, and you've seen this with those who end up getting PTSD, and I think you always have to be conscious of that, because it's actually really exciting to do that and to cover many of these conflicts. And life is simple. You know, for the time that I was gone for 10 days in Mogadishu, everybody's sending you emails, are you okay? You know, there's a lot of love coming from home. It's very straightforward. All you have to do is do your work and stay alive. And then, you know, first day you come home, you're like, oh yeah, my cat pisses in the corner of the kitchen. And, you know, and then the real life comes up and you got to change diapers. And a lot of people, I remember in your documentary, there's one camera person who says, I only feel alive when I'm watching someone die. And he had such an addiction that he realized he couldn't function in life anymore. He needed the adrenaline of the conflict zone. Yeah. Have any of you felt you were on the cusp of kind of needing it a bit? Yeah. And,
I mean, it's not needing the death, it's needing that biggest story. Yeah. No, it's honestly, it's if you're on that story, it means you're on the story.
Right.
You're on the big story. If you're, when the last big earthquake happened in Mexico, I was there within a couple of hours in Mexico City. We immediately went as right in, we gave talked to the security guards who were keeping all the local media out, and I said, I need to be beside that building, or what was that building, And they said, no. And I said, we really do need to be beside that building. And they said, fine. And so we went in, and we were standing from me to you away from the base of that building where we could still, you know, the hand went up and everyone went quiet and you could hear people, something. And that was the biggest story that was being told in the world at that moment. And you were...
And you're part of history.
And you were
exciting.
Part of history. Yeah. And you're going live and your anchor is saying, could you speak louder? And you're saying, well, I can't speak louder because their hands in the air. And yeah. We can't hear, but you're on that big story. Yeah. You're on the story. And I think that's what, which journalist, show me a journalist who wants to do third block stories, and I don't really, I don't
unfortunately, the big stories.
I'll just leave it at that.
The big stories all tend to be the most painful ones, right? So that's just by definition conflict. It makes, and drama and tension makes a good story. So I think we're all drawn to, as Peter said, the story.
But can that be something to watch out for in terms of your mental health? And
well, I mean, I think people who can sustain careers for a long time doing what you do, once again, have a certain biological makeup. I mean, you are the kind of individuals who are attracted to these kind of stories. Because you thrive in them, you're able to function in them, you can confront difficult situations like Kandahar, and you will manage them. There are going to be other people who get into situations like that who will become overwhelmed by fear. They can't do it. I've come across journalists who want to be foreign correspondents, and they do one war, and they will never do another war again because they are so appalled by what they see, they are so terrified by what they experience, they can't sustain it. But there are going to be other individuals like you yourself who can sustain it. And the difference between the two comes back to who you are, not just psychologically, but once again, your biological makeup. You can see these individuals who climb very high mountains, the great mountaineers, will say that when they're high up in the most dangerous of places that are terrifying to us lesser mortals, they come alive. They can function. Everything is working so well. They see the world with a great clarity. And it's the same when you confront the risks of war, that you function well because you are biologically primed that allows you to do it. And I think you can't underestimate this particular variable. If you never had this kind of biological makeup, you would not be able to go back year after year, decade and decade to do this kind of thing. You would struggle. And that's not the same as having an immunity to PTSD or moral injury. It speaks to your desire for a more adventurous life, a more perhaps risky life, the fact that you don't want the 9-to-5 routine. You do not want the kind of career where you get to the office at 9 o'clock and go at 5 and take an hour for lunch and half an hour for tea. That
sounds
will
nice.
Drive you crazy.
Yeah. Well, some days it would be nice.
Yeah, some days.
No,
but think about 30,
no,
think about 30 years of doing that. You would not sustain that.
Yeah.
And so you have to start looking at who you are and what your biology is like to find clues to why you do this.
And then we'll open it up after this.
I'll keep it brief.
Famous last word.
Bill.
Tick tock. Here we go.
It all began at a 10,000-watt radio station in Fresno, California. I too crave the big story. Of course, we all do. That's part of. It's exciting. Big stories, good ones, bad ones, ugly ones, pretty ones. I don't crave a danger, and that a war zone represents a big story, and I will go to it again because it's a big story. In Gaza during the 2014 war, I was there for part of it. Saw some shit I've never seen before and never want to see again in terms of people and weaponry. On the way out, which was insane, things going off all around us, and we're just in a bus trying to get out as fast as we freaking can. And I swear to God, there was a dude in the bus, we'd sort of charted this, who was like Lance out of Apocalypse Now, surfing or something, and he was on the phone to people back in LA, and he was just like, this is awesome. And I thought, what an asshole. Why am I in a bus with an asshole? That's not what we're here for. There's no denying the adrenal rush that those things can bring to you, especially if you get out in one piece, or maybe uniquely if you get out in one piece. But I don't crave it. I crave the journalism and I crave the stories that we told on the streets of Gaza City and to people who are interested in what was going on there. And I love being in the first block, thank you, Donald Trump, every night after night. It's great to be on a big story, as dark and exhausting as that can be. For the just on the Bernardo, I fought to cover the Bernardo trial. I was at that time transitioning slightly into more anchoring than reporting, and I was going to lose this story that I'd been on, and it's like I fought for it. And then in the middle, throughout it, I'm thinking, what the like, what, why are we even telling this every single sort of detail? And yet, of course, because people want to know, it was part of the answer, as sick as that may seem in hindsight. But we questioned that throughout that trial. How much is too much? Right, and yet we all wanted to be on it because it was the biggest story in the country that summer, you know, that and OJ.
I know you wanted questions, but it is about the journals. I remember I was in Libya, and we used these things called BGANs. They basically look like laptops, but with no keyboards. You open them up, and you point them up at the sky, and you find a satellite, and that's how we got our stories out from the middle of the desert. And so we were in the middle of a desert somewhere, and right in the middle of clashes between Gaddafi forces and the rebels. And so I had this story, and we had done all these interviews and amazing stuff that I needed to get out. And so there was sort of this lull, and we pulled off to the side near this huge gate. And so I opened the BGAN, and I found the satellite, and it started uploading from my laptop. And you know, when you're watching, it's like 1%, 2%, 3%. So all of a sudden, almost on cue, there's bombs started falling. And so it was Gaddafi's forces who were shooting towards where we were, because we were in the middle of where their adversaries were. And so they did this thing. My fixer came over and said, they're walking up the road. And what that means is they don't have an exact way of telling how far it is, so they shoot far and then they shoot close, and they start getting until they see you and they hit you. And so you know the bombs are going to come walking up the road, literally exploding as they come. And I'm watching my 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, and I'm thinking, if I close this thing, I will miss my deadline. Wow. And so my security is there, my fixer is there, and they are screaming at me, close it, get in the minivan. And I'm like, I can't.
Wow.
I can't close, and it was coming. And you could hear it, and it was like rhythm. And the rhythm of the bombs were matching the rhythm of the 1%, 2%.
Oh my
and
God.
It was driving me crazy because I wasn't beating the bombs coming up the road. And so it was literally from here to the back of the room, wow. And I was at 98%, 99, and then my fixer came over and slammed the thing down and threw me and everything into the back, and we drove off with like the door open, and right where we were feeding, wow. It blew up. And I wasn't thinking like, this is awesome. I was thinking, you asshole,
yeah.
You closed it at 99% and they didn't get my stand up on the back end of this thing, and the story is ruined. Turns out it hit 100% as he was closing
it.
And I made it, and it was like, you know, like, but wow. It's the journalism of it. It's to, because if I'm there all day for 18 hours right. Eating granola bars and dust, what's the point if nobody sees it?
Yeah.
Right?
This is the best Rogers ad ever.
Just,
yeah, you should see the bill.
So, you know, absolutely. Let me give a more nuanced explanation. You're not doing it for the thrills. I understand that. But if you analyze what you're doing, you are not the fashion reporter. You are not the reporter on the food channel. You are the individual who's in Kandahar or in Tripoli. And the reason why you are there repeatedly, no, it's not necessarily for the thrill, but those are the kind of stories that come with a particular frisson that turns you on, that gives you the meaning in your journalism.
Mm.
And that's the point that I'm trying to make over there. So you combine your love of history, your desire to tell the story, all of those things with those kind of stories that are potentially dangerous, that are potentially risky. Mm-hmm. And you know, why is it? Why have you been able to sustain your career for such a long period doing it? Because to a large degree, you're capable of doing it because of your biology. You know, these things don't happen by chance. There are reasons behind them. Of course, there's an element of free will, and not everything in life is preordained, but there are explanations for why we find ourselves in certain situations. And the biology has a very powerful, if it makes a very compelling argument as to why you're doing it.
Nope.
Joanna, what we've really learned is that people
somebody go to the microphone. Okay.
Saying, isn't it fascinating how the bombs are in rhythm with the percentage points?
Yeah, I know.
Well, what do you think about when you see 1%, 2%? What's there to think of? All that is I'm missing it. You've done it.
If you would please introduce yourself first, and then who you'd like to answer the question.
Sure. It's Graham Harris, and is this on? Testing. Okay. Graham Harrison, I'm on the board of the CJF. Malcolm Gladwell did a wonderful two-piece podcast where he exonerated a journalist for a form of fabrication which might be related to what you guys have been discussing, which is the Brian Williams syndrome, where they teleport themselves into a situation that they believed they actually were in, but they were not. I'm just wondering, have you ever seen it, experienced it, or, you know, how do you feel about what he did vis-a-vis, because it was in a war zone as well. So whether it was manufactured heroics, or I'd be interested in your opinion, as well as yours, Doctor.
I'm the only one on this panel. That's what I'm telling everyone. It's all about a lot of my stories.
That's a good question.
It's interesting how this touched on what we had talked about earlier, but today you wouldn't get away with that because you're called on everything so quickly because there are so many, because of Twitter and because of citizen journalists and everyone's out there. It would be harder to get somebody not responding immediately. But have you, any of you had examples of that where you say you were-
Like, I don't know how Brian Williams got away with that for so long.
Because it was even so, then, yeah.
In hindsight, it's like there's no room for bullshit, basically. And there's no time for it. And no time for people who are bullshitters has been my experience. And so, In fairness, I haven't encountered a lot of that. It was a really freak zone moment. He seemed like such a nice guy, you know? And so I mean.
So you don't forgive him for that?
No, I do not, because it hurt the credibility of all of us. It predated kind of the fake news era.
Yeah.
But it's like, it cast the bullshit shadow. Sorry, we're allowed to swear, right? On all of us, because who knows what's real and what isn't, and what stories are true and what are not, and regardless of how that reflects on your own, you know, war stories, is what does it say about your journalism and the stories you tell about other stuff? It wasn't a good day for any of us, to be honest.
Death by a thousand cuts, truly. It just gives ammunition to those who want to say to us fake news, say those words, to tell us that. That tweet that I put out of the person I spoke with, that I heard them say this, and I sent that out, and then I put it in my online piece and in my story, somebody can say, that's fake news, right? Yeah. It gives them ammo. It destroys everything we do in a day.
Let's go ahead.
Hi. My name is Mark Rosenfeld. I guess my connection to journalism is my son's a journalist in a war zone. And a thing that I'd be interested in, which you haven't touched on yet, but what you've said is fascinating, is the dimensions for freelance journalists. Journalists that, for example, don't have, or mostly don't have the protections of the news organization, that don't have the training, that may not even have the equipment, you know, the helmet and the other protective things that come with the journalism, and are also operating in war zones, going from story to story, going from news organization to news organizations, have to keep on going. And what does that mean, especially in the context of news organizations increasingly relying on freelance journalists to get the story, who work with fixers, and they have obviously, as you mentioned, a dimension there too, but what does that mean as we increasingly rely on freelance journalists, and is what they experience somewhat different than those that are employed full-time?
Thank you for bringing this up. We did want to touch on that. And as somebody who's just recently made the crossover, this was the first time I went to Somalia without kidnap insurance because my own small film company wouldn't be able to be insured. I did a risk-return ratio, and our circumstance really, I was going to get killed if someone tried to get kidnapped because we had our own security, so it was fine. But this is someone who has a lot of resources. Most 25-year-olds, 26-year-olds who are starting out, I really worry about them. And I know at the Star, we would not run freelance pieces from places we wouldn't send our own reporters. But lots of places do. Do you guys have any
thoughts or experience with that?
I was going to say unsung heroes of the industry, because they do it without the tremendous resources that we have behind us. When I was in Haiti very recently, we went with a security crew. A security crew met us there. We didn't travel with them. It's very comforting. And that's true in any high-risk area, and insurance and things like that. It's a complicated business for freelancers. Back to the, I think, maybe the first thing I said was this, how the industry has changed in recent years is this imperative to get closer. And that's especially true for freelancers who have to demonstrate they can get you something that CTV or CBC or The Globe or The Star can't get. So you end up in endangering yourself even more so. You're smart about it. And we do indeed go through the training, which helps us as well. But that's something that CBC and CTV will do to mitigate the risk. But it's complicated, man. And at a time when it's a tough industry as well, right?
There are some bursaries that are offered for freelance journalists to take the hostile environment training course. There's certain areas that I think that is a growing field, because as you say, it's being relied upon more and more as bureaus are shutting and, you know, industry, the media is under strain.
We've collected a database of over 900 frontline journalists over the past 2 decades. And the freelancers are more likely to get depression, but they have more physical difficulties as well. They're more likely to have hypertension and things like diabetes, because they can't manage their health risks. And so it's not just the psychological side of things, but physically, this is such a hard profession, and you see greater physical ailments in the freelancers as well.
So this is all wonderful for your child in the field.
On a happier note, I mean, my advice would be to go where people aren't, and to Joanna's earlier point, tell stories, because they matter. And truth matters, and putting light on any circumstance matters, and you feel good about that. And that helps deal with the shit that they'll also...
Well, and also the best conflict stories are almost always not on the front line.
Exactly.
And they're behind it. And it's sort of that bang bang club mentality is, you know,
100%.
Sometimes
it doesn't have
people.
To be. That's what I always feel is that, you know, you see... You're out in a situation and you see this person who's a freelancer next to you, and you're thinking, who are you selling your stories to? Because what we're doing in the moment is just the news of the day. And if we're there, if I'm there and you're there, then nobody in Canadian television is going to be picking up your piece. Global, they're there too. So who are you feeding it to? And so to both their points, it's tell a story that you won't get anywhere else. And even if it's not where the shells are falling, those are the ones that stick with people. They're not the daily news grind. I've moved into W5 recently, and the stories that I'm now able to tell over a 30-minute or a 50-minute period aren't necessarily the ones that are happening in that moment. They are ones that people will remember. And they don't just wash away with the next roll of the cycle.
Yeah.
And Teresa, our last question.
Hi there. Teresa Epton, Director of Media and Analyst Relations at Accenture, former journalist. And a question for you, Dr. Feinstein. I wondered how the media industry compares when it comes to employers and what they can do to support journalists who are out in the field. They're going through these traumas, you know, perhaps the dark humor develops, all of the different things that we've talked about this evening. But you have other people out in those fields, whether it's doctors, either volunteer with Médecins Sans Frontières, or they're out there working, the military. How does the media industry compare in terms of supporting their workers out in those fields? Are they better, worse? What are they doing and not doing?
You know, I don't know. I think the media has gotten much better at supporting people. I think there's a much greater awareness of the risks that come with this kind of work. certainly over the last two decades, I've seen a sea change in attitudes in Western media about looking after the emotional well-being of journalists. When I travel outside of Canada, when we've done studies in Mexico, Kenya, looking at journalists in Syria, for example, the issues that we discuss now are not even on the table. You know, this just doesn't happen. It's astounding to see what journalists in other countries have to endure without any kind of support from the news organizations. So we do this well within Canada now. And when you compare it to other professions, I don't know. There's a, you know, the United Nations doesn't look after their personnel particularly well. You know, people are sent to do this kind of work and somehow expected to just endure it. But I think, you know, until such time as you've got studies comparing things, this is just anecdotal kind of reports.
I mean, if we could just add, I think there's just been a general shift towards mental health in general in society, and journalist networks have jumped on that. So they will offer counseling or EAP is employment assistance programs and stuff. And there's debriefs more often than when I started. So I think that it just reflects the times more than any the particular industry.
Let's qualify that. I mean, more than when you started was zero.
I remember 9/11, George Hoff, who you're working with now, called us and like, do you guys want a couple of days off? And it was like, maybe. And it was the worst decision we made because we did really well working 16, 18 hours a day and then having our little therapy sessions with drinks. And I think to the points that we've all spoken about, we are our own therapy in the field because we talk to each other. And we allow, like Paul said, you cry after certain moments or certain interviews. And if you don't actually process it, I always find that the offers for help after we get back just feel a little too late.
I would just say that, indeed. I mean, I think CBC is very thoughtful about this stuff, for example. And I think in one of the early notes among us beforehand, we all know people who either are explicitly suffering or we wonder about. But the challenge to me is beforehand. I think CBC, if people are recognized as struggling with stuff at some point, whether after a specific assignment or after a stretch of them, but we don't really have any real answers, but we're aware of it, and there's talk that goes on, but it's the before that I think is like to the point of who's at risk and who isn't. But it's not like it's just a new thing either. After the Bernardo trial, we were given a session, right? Go in to talk to somebody and just in case. This was very early days of this kind of stuff, right? And I remember going to some hotel room somewhere and feeling kind of weird about it, but sit down and the person said, so how have you been, you know, coping with this stuff? And I said, well, glad you asked. I set myself three rules in the course of that trial. Number one, sorry, Peter, no jokes. And by that I mean dark humor, which comes up in a lot of stories. And I felt it was entirely inappropriate on that story. It was too brutal. So nothing. Two. Every lunch hour, take a break. Don't freak out about the rest of the day ahead or just like go somewhere for half an hour. And this will date me, but I went to Sam the Record Man and I went into the classical section and just listened to, like just pretended to browse albums and chilled
eight
out.
Eight tracks, right?
Was it eight tracks? Yes, right. And the third thing was a rule that Joanna and Peter will appreciate because it was complicated, which was in every two-minute story, and there were going to be a lot of them that summer, every single story was going to have Leslie and Kristen in it. It was not going to be about him, or we would not forget the girls, let's say. And it was an editorial decision because of course that's 15 precious seconds that you could tell another sordid detail about Bernardo, God forbid, right? They would be in every single story, which is easier said than done, because every day it has to be written differently. Yeah. You've got the confines of a very tightly assigned length of story. It's got to look different for the people who've been watching every day, but it's got to have substance for those who are just watching tonight for the first time. But I did it, and I felt it empowered those two, and I felt better about all of that for sticking to those three things. And the person in the room in the hotel at the end of it all said, congratulations, I don't need to talk to you. And I said, right on.
Self-care.
Anyway, so it has been around for a while, but it is certainly, there's been an uptick lately in talking about this stuff afterward, which to which for the CBC, I'm grateful. I know CTV is the same. So.
Yeah. And this is, sorry.
Part of what I did for, I have been doing for the last two decades is I'm a video journalist. So I shoot and edit and report, which means I don't have a cameraman with me or a producer or what have you. And so in Afghanistan, I was there, for those 8 weeks by myself. The other reporters who were there were from other networks, but no other, I was with CBC at the time, no other CBCer. And so that part of it starts to grind on you because you start talking to yourself so that you hear a voice that you can trust. And the same then happened, the five Olympics I've covered, I've done as a VJ. There's lots of journalists around Olympic Games, but again, you're by yourself. So you're screaming at your editor, who's you, to make your deadline, and you're screaming at your cameraman to line you up quick so you can do your live hit, and again, that's you. And so that stuff starts wearing on you.
Do you scream back? Or?
I do, actually. And in my ear, they said, can you ask your cameraman to zoom out? So I'd walk forward, and I'd zoom out my camera. And they'd say, could you thank him for me? And I said, thanks.
So, good shot.
Yeah. A little more headroom. Really? Come on.
This is why he's sitting right close
yes.
to Dr. Munch.
Help me. Help me help you. I'm fine. Let's have drinks.
And on that perfect note, I just want to, I would hope this would be like you were all sitting around having a cocktail with us. And guess what? You can now do that. So if there's other questions, please feel free to come up to the panelists afterwards. And just thank you so much for being such a great, attentive audience. Thank you, my brave colleagues. And thank you, CJF, for doing this. And let me please introduce Natalie Turvey.
On behalf of the CJF, I want to echo Michelle's thanks. This has been an extraordinary and intimate hour of discussion with our stellar panel. And Peter can say that it's water off a duck's back or the jokes, but there's a unique kind of bravery to the work that you all do at home and abroad, telling stories and not just reporting on numbers, but telling the human story that engages audiences and makes them care about the world around us. So thank you so much for being with us. And our thanks to Anthony for sharing the important work he's doing on moral injury. It's vitally important that our newsrooms better understand the stresses of reporting on trauma, better prepare our journalists for the risks, and most importantly, that they're able to adequately support them. So it's been an honor to have you with us as well. And Michelle Shepherd, what a jerk.
Agree.
We adore Michelle. She's incredibly generous to the CJF. And to do this after hopping off a flight, we're so grateful for the work she put into making this a discussion we can all benefit from. So a round of applause for all of our speakers. Have a few more events this season, and we hope you'll join us. On May 2nd, the CJF is hosting the second annual World News Day North America on the eve of World Press Freedom Day to celebrate the power of journalism in the world. The event is hosted by CNN's Brian Stelter and will feature top North American journalists and their sources speaking to how journalism affected powerful and positive change in their lives and their communities. We'll have inspiring musical performances as well, and proceeds from World News Day go to support the CJF's Indigenous Journalism Fellowships. And on May 9th, if you're up for a road trip, we are heading to Calgary with Canada's top news leaders, talking about strategies for covering the Western Canada as we head into the federal election. On May 28th, Margaret Sullivan, the Washington Post media critic, will be with us to address the current media landscape from shifting business models to the media's relationship with the U.S. president. And it's gala season, and on June 13, we are celebrating outstanding journalistic achievement at the CJF Annual Awards Gala. Anne-Marie Medawake is our host, and Time Magazine's Person of the Year and Press Freedom icon, Maria Ressa, is with us for a tribute to her courage, along with Washington Post's executive editor, Marty Baron, who will be honored for his commitment to the highest standards of journalism. Along with our other awards and fellowships for excellence, emerging and mid-career journalists, we are proud to recognize Torstar Chair John Hondrick with our Lifetime Achievement Award. This is our fifth annual event at TD. Our thanks to Paolo Paschini and the leadership at TD for giving us a stage tonight to highlight the vital importance of journalism in our country. We're grateful for your support, and this view never gets old, and you will see it in the cocktail reception. And thanks to all of you for coming out to support the work of the CJF. As Michelle said, please join us in the other room to continue the conversation. Thank you so much.